Writers' Voices. I'm Cheryl Fusco Johnson, and with me hosting today is Carolyn Kilbourn. And we have a wonderful guest with us today. Her name is Carolyn Preston. As a girl growing up in Lake Forest, Illinois, Carolyn Preston used to pore through her grandmother's and mother's scrapbooks and started collecting antique scrapbooks when she was in high school. She majored in American Studies at Dartmouth College and received a master's in American Civilization from Brown University. Inspired by her interest in manuscripts and ephemera, she worked as an archivist at the Rhode Island Historical Society, the Peabody Essex Museum, and Harvard's Houghton Library. Carolyn is the author of three previous novels. Jackie by Josie, a New York Times Notable Book of the Year, was drawn from her brief researching stint for a Jackie O biography. Gatsby Girls, Gatsby's Girl, chronicles F. Scott Fitzgerald's first girlfriend, who was the model for Daisy Buchanan. In the scrapbook of Frankie Pratt, and that's the very interesting book that we're going to be talking about today. It's really unique.
Very unique.
She's drawn from her own collection of vintage ephemera to create a novel in the unique form of a scrapbook, and I wish we could show it to everybody who's listening because it's a really beautiful book. Carolyn has been awarded a Massachusetts Artist Foundation Fellowship and has had residences at YADU, the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, and Ragdale, where she is a distinguished artist. She lives with her husband, the writer Christopher Tillman, in Charlottesville, Virginia, and has three mostly grown-up sons. Welcome.
Welcome. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're thrilled you could join us.
I like that, mostly grown-up. I know what you mean.
In their 20s. I think most parents feel that way about their 20-something or old children.
Right. The 20s are really a challenging age, I think, harder than a lot of other decades. I'd rather be almost any age than in my 20s.
Yeah, I think... some friends of mine were talking yesterday about how things have changed since we were teenagers, you know, and it's quite a bit different.
Well, speaking of the 20s, your book is set in the 20s. Tell us a little about how you came to create a book in this form.
Well, the novel is, it actually looks like a 1920s scrapbook, and I came up with that idea two years ago when I was, just after I finished Gatsby's Girl, and I was working on a fourth novel, and I was wanting to set it in Paris in 1920s because my mother's godmother was Sylvia Beach and who run a very famous bookstore in Paris during the 20s, Shakespeare and Company. So I spent a lot of time looking through old scrapbooks from the 1920s, belonging to people like Sylvia Beach and my grandmother, and also to F. Scott Fitzgerald's scrap and Zelda's kept amazing scrapbooks. And I was just struck at how vivid they were in terms of looking at the objects and the artifacts and the letters from that period. And I was thinking, well, I just really wish I could capture the feeling of an old scrapbook in my novel. And then I just had this great light bulb went off, and I just thought, well, why don't I try and create an actual scrapbook that reads like a novel?
I think that was a great idea because it sort of spans the generations in terms of an audience, because I understand this won an award for young adult readers, but to me it seems like something that older people would also find really interesting just because of, you know, all the objects that you have pictured in there.
I think so, and I also think it isn't just people that, were alive during the 20s, but I think that people have a tremendous interest in the 20s, and it's so interesting to look at. There are all manner of kinds of material in the book, from, you know, magazine covers and advertisements and tickets and menus and pictures of old cars and things about the events of the 1920s, such as Prohibition and the invention of the radio. And, you know, people are very curious about that. And just sort of see the objects from that period all glued together, you get a real sense not only of the story of this woman, but also of the period.
And the clothing styles are interesting, aren't
they?
Oh, the
fashions are so beautiful.
Yeah, they are.
They're really
beautiful.
Yeah.
And, I should say that any of your listeners who are interested in looking at the book or hearing more about how I created it should go to my website.
Would you like to share the address for your website?
Yes, that is CarolinePreston, all one word, .com.
You might want to spell your last name so people will be able to find it easily.
It's Caroline, Preston.
That's great, and it's a very nicely
all
done.
Of, and they're film, you know, there's some interviews with me, and there are pages from the book, and there's a lot about how I created the book in it.
And I think there are either even some video on YouTube about the book that people can look at online.
But yeah, those are also on my website too. Yeah.
So was this especially complicated because of all the physical objects involved? Like, did you have a whole room of your house dedicated to cataloging and keeping this stuff straight?
I do have, well, it's my office or my studio, and yes, I do have a whole room in my house, and in fact, I'm sitting in that room in my house looking at this, all these stacks and piles of things. Yes, it was complicated. I did a tremendous, I mean, as I collected over 600 pieces of 1920s ephemera.
Wow.
Gave this book, and I collected, I went into antique stores and antique malls in Virginia, Massachusetts, New York, Mississippi, Illinois, in all in my travels, and I bought a lot of things on eBay, and I collected a vast number of old magazines that I cut up. And so, yeah, it was, you know, kind of keeping all that organized and then sort of then translating it into... and then I created the scrapbook as this young woman would, as a young girl would keep, I mean, a girl who's 18 years old to 28 years old would keep a scrapbook.
Did you lay out the pages yourself, and or did you have like a graphic designer or someone?
Oh, I did the whole thing myself.
So you photographed these, you laid out the pages and photographed them, and that's then what became the finished book.
That is correct, although I didn't, they were professionally photographed, but yes. Yes, I laid out the actual pages, and because I, you know, and it is not something that I could sort of do on Photoshop or something, just because I wanted the sort of three-dimensional aspect of all of these things sort of stacking up and piling up and glued together, like a real scrapbook, and then the whole pages were photographed, and then the story of the book is created in caption, you know, or typed, you know, on old typewriter captions or letters in the book.
Well, what are you going to do with all those, like, 600 objects? Are you actually going to... Don't you have to move some of those out so you can write your next graphic novel?
I have moved some of them out. I actually have now. I've moved some of them out, and then I've moved all sorts of things in for my next book. Well, yeah, it's a bit of a challenge. I mean, I have... I do have a lot of leftover things, which I've... You know, I'm doing things like, you know, matting, that, you know, some of the fashion prints and giving them to people and things like that. I mean, I will... You know, pass them along in good ways.
That's cool.
You know, scrapbooking, of course, came into its own about, 15 years ago as a hobby. But before that, I mean, when I was growing up, nobody much did scrapbooks, you know, so it comes and goes.
It has become a hobby, but it also was a very, very popular hobby before. I mean, there is a sort of long American tradition of keeping scrapbooks. Thomas Jefferson kept scrapbooks. Mark Twain kept so many scrapbooks that he was so kind of avid that he patented a style of scrapbook.
Really? Oh, for heaven's sake.
Mark Twain patented scrapbook, and there's a picture of that on my website. And he made more money on the patent, his patented scrapbooks, than he did on all his novels combined.
Wow, that's really interesting.
During the teens, 20s, you know, all the way till about 1950, during World War II, people really kept scrapbooks. They recorded, and they kept them very artistically. I mean, they really made them sort of interesting and different kinds of material. You know, they almost, you know, you wouldn't put in beautiful things. You'd sort of put in, you know, a napkin with a lipstick blot on it or something and say, this is when I, you know, was having dinner with so-and-so. And so it was just a very interesting way of recording and keeping a diary about your life.
I also saw some that were, they were just articles from the newspaper or magazines pasted onto scrapbook pages and then kept in a scrapbook. I've seen those, too, for whatever reason.
Well, clippings. And people did keep a lot of clippings.
Yes,
and
they did.
And in a way, it was their way, you know, sort of keeping things organized. You know, you'd read something in the newspaper is interesting to you or about you, and you'd sort of keep a track of it.
Well, we didn't have the internet, and we didn't.
It was different.
It was different. Times were different. Yes, they were.
So when you were getting your education, going to Brown and studying Western, what was it, Western civilization or American civilization?
Studies.
American, your master's. Did you foresee this kind of a career for yourself?
Well, I sort of did, actually, because I was always really interested in ephemera, and I had collected antique Valentines and antique scrapbooks since I was in high school. So I had a big collection of sort of old paper, and it was that interest in that that made me go to graduate school, and then I went on to have a career as an archivist. So this kind of old paper and stuff is not a new interest.
Well, I love that about this book, that it's sort of an extension of, it's almost like no one else could have done this. I mean, it really is an extension of your life, because you had that, you know, early fascination with documents and bits of things that your mother and grandmother had saved.
That's really right. And the way that they can tell, you know, and I would study all the letters and scrapbooks of my parent, my mother, and sort of see this, how they tell an incredible story. And so bringing that kind of, you know, and sort of bringing the way that isn't just interest in paper, but just the way also that it can tell a story about someone's life in a very different way than if you just, you know, you read someone's diary or read their letters. And so taking that interest in the narrative and being able to turn it into a novel, yeah. I mean, I don't know if I'm the only person who could have done it, but it...
But you were the natural...
Physical extension of my interest.
Yeah, it's sort of like the sum total of a lot of your experiences kind of led to this. Did you take any art courses?
I have not been formally trained as a graphic artist, and when I first started this book, I did take a course from a friend of mine who is a book artist, and that was sort of helpful. But you know, I think the way I did this and the reason why I could do this is because I was recreating an old scrapbook. So, you know, I just made it look like an old scrapbook. I didn't have to look, you know, like a beautifully designed book. I mean, it, you know, so I felt like I'm gluing this together the way someone would keep a scrapbook. So if it seems,
it could be quirky.
Yeah, it could be quirky, or, yeah, it doesn't have to be, you know, or it can be non-symmetrical or sloppy or something, and that's just part of it. And if it has a homemade look to it, that's just the way that they looked.
Well, it's sort of like every author studies the genre that they're writing in. You know, you have to go through an apprenticeship where you read a lot of, like if you're writing mysteries, you read a lot of mysteries, you kind of take them apart and really study them. It's you've done the same thing because you had this lifelong exposure to scrapbooks, so you understood the parameters.
I did, and when I was doing this one, I particularly studied scrapbooks from the 1920s, and, you know, as I'm moving on and doing a lighter subject, I'm studying scrapbooks from that era. And, you know, there's a couple books on scrapbooks, too. There's one that's by a woman named Jessica Helfen, which is really very interesting, has a lot of illustrations, and is a nice overview of the history of scrapbooks.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what the scrapbook of Frankie Pratt generates, if it might perhaps set off more interest in, I mean, I think there has been, as Caroline said, an interest in scrapbooking that kind of surged maybe 15 years ago. But I wonder if more people will try writing for publication in this form. You know, it's just kind of interesting to see what's going to follow.
I think this book has had a real appeal to people who keep scrapbooks. And I mean, you know, or scrapbookers, as they're called. But so I think that people have sort of seen how you can integrate a narrative or a real storyline in a scrapbook. And, you know, people, I mean, I've gotten reactions from people saying, gosh, I wish I'd written this, or I think I'm going to try writing this. So we'll see. You know, it is a natural extension of keeping a scrapbook or keeping a journal to try and kind of create a story like this.
I want to remind listeners, you're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM. The show that you're listening to is Writers' Voices. I am Cheryl Fusco-Johnson. Co-hosting is Caroline Kilborn. We have a very interesting author with us today named Carolyn Preston, and she's written a scrapbook, the Scrapbook of Frankie Pratt, which is an historical novel told not just through text, but also through a lot of pictures of objects, what we're calling ephemera, like tickets and recipes and pictures of old typewriters, and it's just really a fascinating book.
I was interested to see in that one, on the one place where you wrote about the picnic that was packed, and you have that picture of the devil's, you know,
the Underwood deviled hand.
Yeah, that's so funny. Yeah, I know.
But that struck me too, because when I got a scholarship to go to Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts, when I was 16, and I'd never been away from home, I'd never ridden a plane. And it was a very different milieu than, you know, what I was used to. And
well, that must have been a culture shock.
It was really great fun to be, you know, that's the first time I studied writing was there. And my parents sent me a care package, and it had a can of that Underwood deviled ham in it. You know, I saw that picture.
If you're missing it, right?
Well, I can't say that's true, but it did really bring back memories of,
yeah,
you know, a whole different era. It's just like, it's odd how objects can evoke that.
When I was looking at collecting these things, there's a lot of these products that we think of, like Jell-O and popsicles and different kind of food products. They existed during the 20s. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily thought they did.
Well, I was interested in the Smith's cough drops, and that was a family that owned a luncheonette that was in a house, because my grandfather used to give us Smith's cough drops. You know, they came in licorice and cherry, and it's just amazing to me that just seeing your picture of a box of Smith's cough drops can, like, evoke a whole different era in my life for me. So I just
think, right, and whoever thought that, you know, I remember Smith's cough drops. I'm not sure they make them anymore, but, you know, that they actually came from a restaurant in Poughkeepsie, you know, sold them, I mean, or created them. I mean, you know, so, I mean, yes, it is this interesting thing that you would never think of. I mean, that was the fascinating thing of doing this history, is I would come across all these little facts and then somehow work them in.
So you're married to an author, too, right?
Yes, I am. Christopher Tillman.
And so is he your first reader?
He is. I mean, he, in fact, started writing way before I did. I mean, I was married to a writer for, you know, 20 years before I started writing myself. Maybe not that long, 10 years. So, you know, it's kind of interesting sort of seeing his process and his apprenticeship. And then I didn't start writing until I was in my early 40s. And I had three kids, and I had worked as an archivist before then, but then I stopped and started writing novels. So he was, in fact, he's a writing teacher, and, you know, he was my first reader and has always given me incredibly good advice and sort of direction or suggestions for my work. So it is wonderful being married to a writer, but as I say, I always feel like, you know, he's so much more senior, you know, experienced at this than I am.
Well, I'm not familiar with his work, but certainly your scrapbook novel in pictures must be very different than what he's writing.
Yeah, it is. He is. I mean, he writes a lot about Maryland. He actually has a new novel coming out called The Right Hand Shore, which is coming out in about 3 weeks, and that's about Reconstruction of Maryland, you know, after the Civil War.
Oh, that sounds like it. So he's interested in historical.
Yes, he is, very much so.
And he's an award-winning writer as well. I seem to recall that he had gotten honored for some of his earlier books.
He's also the director of the writing program at the University of Virginia.
Oh, sounds like a really busy person.
He is a busy person, yes, he is. Right now he's feeling very too busy.
So what's that like when you're writing? Like, do you each have your own study?
And we do. You know, I mean, it's not, you know, now that we're, you know, our children are out of the house and things, I mean, it's sort of, you know, we're both kind of working on our own projects and doing our own thing and talk about them all the time, but, so it isn't like we're, you know, if anything, we're just sort of commiserate with one another because, you know, there are lots of ups and downs in a writer's life, you know, working on things that you don't feel are working out to, you know, the difficulty these days in publishing. And, you know, it's nice to have someone who's on your side.
Well, it's interesting that your book seems to me like it's on a line of a vanguard of what's happening in publishing, because it does seem as though, you know, of course, it's going through a lot of changes. And some people are predicting that some print books will continue to exist, and that some of those print books will be artisanal, like very special, beautiful books. You were talking about taking a course in book arts. The book that you created in the scrapbook of Frankie Pratt sort of follows in that tradition of a very fine, beautiful book with like thick pages and beautiful illustrations on every page and beautiful end papers, you know, glued to the cover. So did you think about that consciously at all, that you were creating like a, sort of an artisanal book?
I think so. I mean, it is in fact an extremely, you know, I mean, my hats are off to HarperCollins for just creating this magnificent book. I mean, it's so beautiful looking. It is such a beautiful job. But I think, I hope that it will have a wider audience. And you know, it is available on an iPad. And I think that, you know, I see a future for my books also being available in some electronic form.
I talked to an editor on the show last week, and her prediction was that we're all going to be reading books in multiple formats. So that, you know, there will be electronic versions of books, but there'll also be print versions of books. I have to admit, I do read books electronically, but I also really like the feel of a book.
Uh-huh.
How about you, Caroline?
I do. Well, I have quite a library, and I like the looks of books. You know what I mean? I know it's a possession, and we shouldn't be attached to possessions, but it's hard because some of those books I've had for a long time, and you know, I cherish them. And I don't know. I don't have an electronic.
I think there's a place for all these different things.
There is, yeah.
And there is a place for electronic books too. And I think, you know, I hope that my books will, I mean, I hope that they won't be just considered like artisanal in terms of you know, like a rare book. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, I would like, you know, I want my books to be read, you know, be available in libraries and be available to regular readers. I mean, that's important to me.
Well, this is a beautiful book, and it speaks to people in a lot of different generations, so I think it will be widely read and widely enjoyed. And I'm wondering how you feel about the marketing process.
Well, that was really interesting, because this is my fourth book, and it has been the world for marketing a book has changed vastly since I published my last book in 2006, in terms of the amount of reviews and interest that is online. So this is the first time that I had a fully developed website and was on Facebook and Twitter. I don't Twitter, but I mean, my book is Twittered about all the time. And that there's vast, vast communities of readers. I mean, through Goodreads and through other things of you know, people that are blogging about books. All different kinds of people blog about books, from just women who are readers and reading in book groups to people that are book artists and scrapbook keepers. And yeah, it's a new world here in terms of the way people are communicating about books. Some of the older methods of publicizing books through magazine reviews and newspaper reviews are, alas, you know, ever dwindling.
Well, that's actually kind of an upside to the changes, isn't it? That these communities of readers, of book readers, are finding and communicating with each other.
I think it is. I mean, yes, there is something that is coming in their place, and I'm really, really grateful for it. Rather than just have papers die away and then nothing come into its place. I think there is, wide audience, large audiences of readers and people who are in book groups and people who are write about the books they're enjoying and share it with their friends. And so I think that's very heartening.
Do you spend much time online, like being interviewed on blog posts, or like, are you doing much of that social media marketing yourself?
I did a lot of it when the book first came out. I'm not doing so much anymore because I'm kind of focusing on my my new work. I do some. I do some with blog posts and communicating that way. You know, quite honestly, you know, I think, and the writer would tell you this, all that stuff is really, really time consuming, and a lot of the time I spend online, I think I should probably, you know, have better things I should be doing. I mean, it will suck up all your time, and it'll suck up all your reading time, too. I mean, you'll spend more time reading things on blogs than you will be reading a book.
It's very addictive.
Yeah.
So it is addictive, but I don't think it's necessarily such a productive use of your time. So
tell us about your new endeavor. What are you working on?
I am working on, you know, I'm sort of switching it around a little bit, but I am writing about a bride's first year of marriage, and it's a scrapbook, and I am changing the setting a little bit, but I believe it's going to be set in during World War II.
Oh, very good, very good.
So I'm having a lot of fun with thinking about correspondence and all the sort of wonderful artifacts and sort of material, of, you know, from the home front during World War II.
You know, that has changed so much now from now, because now they can Skype.
Oh yeah, that's true. Soldiers in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and when my uncle was in World War II in Germany, and my aunt would get letters, and half of them would be blacked out. You know,
I have letters like that my father sent my mother, and it's like you can read 15 words
on
the page, and everything else is blacked out.
Yeah, so it's really changed.
Miniature letters, you mean the one, the V-mail
right.
or whatever?
Yeah, yeah.
It's really changed.
Photocopied.
Yes, the little tiny pictures of letters. So I have maybe, I don't know, five or six of those that he sent her. And they're very sweet and romantic, the parts that aren't blacked out.
But they couldn't, you know, they didn't, what was it, loose lips sink ships.
Right.
That was the slogan, yeah.
Will you be doing traveling? It seems like there was a lot of changes in scene in the scrapbook of Frankie Pratt. Do you think that you'll be doing traveling to research different places?
Doing my research? I think that it's going to be set in Virginia and Norfolk, and so I think I will be traveling, but probably more locally. At least that's my plan right now.
Well, I'm going to do another station identification, and I'm wondering if while I'm doing that, you could find a little excerpt to read to from your book for us.
Oh, sure. Yep.
And I want to remind listeners, this is KRUU 100.1 FM. You're listening to Writers' Voices. Your hosts today are me, Cheryl Fusco Johnson, and Caroline Kilborn. We have a wonderful guest with us, very original writer. Her book that we're discussing is her fourth book, and it's The Scrapbook of Frankie Pratt, A Novel in Pictures. So, Carolyn, would you like to share an excerpt of the book with us?
Well, I'm going to read two short excerpts. And the book, again, it is a scrapbook, but it's illustrated with typed captions. And so I'm going to just read you from the first page. And the story is about a woman named Frankie Pratt It begins in 1920, and she's 18 years old, and she's just gotten an old Corona portable typewriter and a scrapbook as a high school graduation present. And so this is the sort of first page she types. Frances Pratt, personal information. Nickname, Frankie. Hate the name Frances. Birthday, September 5th, 1902. Address, Cornish Flat, New Hampshire. Height, 5 feet 7, weight, 116 pounds, hair, strawberry blonde, with streaks in summer, nose, straight, thin, can look too pointy from the left-hand side. And then I'm going to read a little bit later, actually much later, where after she's graduated from college, and she goes to sort of seek her fortune in Greenwich Village, and it's in 1924. I arrive in New York City. A week after graduation, I roll into Grand Central Station, check my two suitcases and typewriter with the red cap, and buy a guidebook at the newsstand. Vincent told me Greenwich Village was the only place for an artist to live. So, how do you start to seek your fortune? Here is my to-do list. 1. Find my way around New York City by map. 2. Figure out subway and buses. 3. Find place to live. 4. Open bank account. 5. Find job. 6. Write novel. 7. Get novel published. 8. find the love of my life. Map in hand, I descend the iron stairs into the dim racket of the East Side subway. All I need to do is get off at Astor Place and head west. Sounds easy enough.
Yes, and?
Oh, I'm just going to leave you there.
Okay. But that does give us sort of like what some of the through lines of the story are, because you start with her 18, and, you know, at first it looks like she's not going to be able to go to college as she had hoped because there isn't the money for it. But she's looking for two things in her life. She's looking for satisfaction in a career, and she's looking for love.
Right.
And
exactly.
There are a lot of ups and downs in that journey that she takes.
There are, and that's right. In a lot of the ways that she goes, she is disappointed and heads off in another direction.
Well, that's happened to all of us, hasn't it?
There's definitely some false starts.
Definitely.
Some bad romantic.
Yeah. Makes some bad romantic choices.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
She makes a couple of them.
Yeah.
Sort of part of the fun.
And it is fun that it's sort of. I don't want to give anything away, but you know, it ends with her at a more mature level. And finding
happy ending.
Yeah, happy ending.
Happy endings are good.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
I'm kind of old-fashioned in terms of that, you know,
yeah.
Writing novels that have happy endings.
Well, there are happy endings in life as well, you know?
There are.
So I'm kind of curious about this bookstore, because this bookstore that you mention in Paris, was it in Paris?
Bixbourne Company.
And so it seemed like a lot of famous expatriate writers frequented this bookstore?
Yeah, it was a famous bookstore. Sylvia Beach was a woman from New Jersey when she was about 30 years old. This is in 1919. She went to Paris, and she opened up an English language bookstore, and it was on the Left Bank. And she also had a lending library of English books, and she would... You know, people could have their mail sent there and various things, and it sort of became a clubhouse for expats. And it's a very famous place. It's actually described in a lot of detail in Ernest Hemingway's A Movable Feast, which is about his life in Paris in the 20s. And also, I mean, it appears a little bit in this new novel, The Paris Wife. But the thing that Sylvia Beach did, which also made her very famous, is she was the first person who published James Joyce's Ulysses.
That was a really interesting aspect of the book, because I hadn't realized that books were banned in the 20s.
That book was very much banned. I mean, excerpts of it were published in an American magazine called The Little Review, and they were very shocking. The Comstock Law, which forbid anything that was seen as pornographic from being sent through the mails, and so it really could not be published in the United States. And so, in order to get it published, they published it in Paris. And no one really wanted to take on publishing Ulysses because it was this vast, complicated book, and Sylvia Beach, who just, didn't have any money and didn't have any training as an editor, sort of stepped up and said, I'll do it.
What an interesting person. Now, how was she related to your family? She was godmother to your...
But an old friend of my grandmother's from, 1910, from a long time before. But my grandmother had lived in Illinois. She got married and lived in Illinois. But she named her first child, my mother... Sylvia, after
Sylvia. Oh, how interesting.
And Sylvia Beach was my mother's godmother.
Does this bookstore still exist?
Well, Shakespeare and Company, the bookstore does exist, but it is under a different incarnation. I mean, Sylvia Beach herself had the store. She closed it during World War II. It was actually closed by the Nazis, and she never opened it again. And then an American... who's an admirer of hers, opened another English-language bookstore in Paris in the early 60s, I think. And anyway, that's still open. That's in Paris, yeah. It's on the Left Bank. It's not in the same location as her store, but...
Did you go there and see where the original store
was? I have been there, and I'm going to be there again, because I'm going to be there this summer, because my husband and I are giving a reading at the American Library in Paris, and
fun.
They're going to sell my book. So, yeah, it'll be really... fun to go back to Paris and talk about this book.
Well, Monica, the person who created the Writers' Voices show, is also making a trip to Paris before too long, and she's been talking about this bookstore because she also read your book, even though she's not here with us today. So she was particularly interested in hearing, you know, what you had to say about it. It sounds like that would have been quite a, you know, a meeting ground if that's where people could get their mail and that's where they could buy books in English. And but getting back to the banned books thing, that was so interesting to me. I remember when I was growing up, the only exposure I had to the fact that books were banned was I was Catholic, and they would read lists of books that we weren't supposed to read from the priesthood.
Well, run out and read them, right?
Yeah, it's like I never did that, actually, but it certainly made you want to, you know, as soon as somebody tells you you can't read something.
Yeah, whatever they tell you you can't do, oh, yeah, that's what I'm going to
do. Exactly, especially if you're a teenager, you know, it's, you know, sort of gasoline on the fire, right?
Right.
One of my friends is a children's writer, and she wrote a picture book called My Mom's Having a Baby, and it a list of the most censored books in the U.S. came out, I guess, last week, and her book was number 4 on the list, and we're all scratching our heads as to, you know, why some people think certain things need to be censored. So I guess some people didn't like that she used real-life language, you know, for how babies are born, and but it's interesting to see the history of censorship.
It is, yeah.
It is really interesting, and certainly there was a very strong, I mean, a lot of books, you know, from J.D. Salinger to D.H. Lawrence, and their books were banned for years. I mean, it's sort of amazing that, you know, Lady Chatterley's Lover wasn't published in this country till 1960. It was banned for that long.
So we do kind of take for granted our easy access to all different kinds of literature.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. And there was a very strong sense that this was corrupting and not to let people be able to read it.
So do you have much interaction with students? You're telling us your husband is a director of the writing program at his school.
I do have a, I mean, I you know, he's, I mean, I see his students all the time, and in fact, two of his students have done incredibly well. You know, their books were sort of like named by the New York Times as the best novels of the year, which is by Chad Harbach, The Art of Fielding, which is a book that's gotten a lot of, been on the bestseller list, and a woman named Eleanor Henderson, who wrote a novel called 10,000 Saints. So,
what was the first one, The Art of Healing?
It's called The Art of Fielding. It's about
Fielding.
Baseball.
Oh, okay.
It's a, you know, it's been a huge hit, you know, bestseller this, you know, since the end of the year.
Well, that's great. It must be very rewarding for him to see his students doing so well.
Oh, yeah, it is. And, you know, there was a book festival. They have a big book festival in Charlottesville every year, and, you know, a lot of his students come back. So they've gone, a lot of them have gone on to have great success, and that's really rewarding.
So you originally, it sounds like, were not intending to be an author.
I wasn't. I thought that I would be working as an archivist, as a librarian. And I, you know, when I did have something of a midlife crisis, and when I was about in my early 40s, after I'd had my third child, you know, I just was finding the, you know, I was feeling frustrated with my work. I was feeling that it was too constrained and not creative enough, and I sort of wanted to do something that was more creative, and I wanted to write. And I didn't really think that I had the discipline to do such a thing. And, you know, because I, in a way, I became more disciplined after I had children, which is, you know, I was able to sort of focus more on my work because, and, you know, I think it's, I have to say the opposite is true for a lot of people, but a lot of women who are trying to kind of go back to work after having kids. But I just found that when I had childcare and, you know, I could grab those precious hours of writing, I just was able to really focus in and sort of be productive in a way that hadn't been before.
Well, you had in your home a writing teacher, so that sounds helpful. But what did you do to sort of master the craft? Did he give you, like, tips, books to read, or?
I did a couple of sort of summer workshops at at Bennington, which at that point hadn't had a summer workshop. Now they just have an MFA program. And I, you know, and those were each like 2 weeks long. And I studied with a couple of really good people. One was Joe McCorkle, and who's a Southern writer, and the other one's Ellie Lippman. And so those were just really important friendships and important relationships that I just, and I did something that is not actually very recommended to do at all, and which is I did not do the normal apprenticeship of writing short stories. I just sat down and started to write a novel. And that was...
Well, they're two very different... I don't think that short story writers can always transition to become novelists. I think it's a, you know, it's a particular form, and it certainly teaches you, like writing a short story certainly teaches you, you know, how to do dialogue and how to establish a tone and how to decide on a narrative voice, maybe into whether or not you want to be consistent with voice and, you know, all those technical things. But it's a very different form than a novel.
Oh, I think absolutely. It's just more that it's, rather than invest all the time in a novel, your time might be better spent writing short pieces where you're sort of practicing different parts of craft. And I think that probably is the way to do it. It is not the way I did it at all. I mean, I just sat down and started writing novels. And, but, you know, I think it's just the way my mind worked. And, you know, it turned out okay.
Well, certainly did.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your earlier books.
My first book is called Jackie by Josie, and it was inspired by a real job that I had, which was doing research for a Jackie Kennedy biographer named Ed Klein, and I had a brief job doing that and thought, you know, and actually when he asked me, this is because I had cataloged Teddy White papers at Harvard, and he... one day, this man called me up, so would I like to be a Jackie Kennedy, you know, do some research for him. And I just thought, this, you know, was beneath me. And so, you know, as I was in the process of being sort of offended that he even asked me to do such a thing, I said, well, how much will you pay me to do it? And so that kind of gave me the idea for the novel, which is about a graduate student who sort of stuck on her dissertation and starts to... and gets hired by a Jackie Kennedy biographer, and then ends up finding all these strange parallels in Jackie Kennedy's life with her own, which is on the surface completely different. And then my second novel is about a woman who writes computer games, and the novel itself sort of resembles a kind of mythic quest, which is kind of like the computer games that she invents. My third novel, Gatsby's Girl, was inspired by the real-life story of Ginevra King, who was F. Scott Fitzgerald's first girlfriend. And Fitzgerald met her when he was 19 at Princeton, and she was a very wealthy girl from Illinois, and he fell madly in love with her and carried a flame for her for many, many years. And she later became the model for Daisy Buchanan in The Great Gatsby.
That sounds really interesting.
And really, from her point of view, later in her life, as she sort of looks back on her own life through the lens of being a Scott Fitzgerald character.
Well, that sounds like that'd be a really interesting book. I'll have to look into some of your other books.
Well, thank you.
Which must be quite different. I mean, the process of doing them must have been much different than doing this one that has so many artistic, you know, like visual qualities to it.
I mean, it is. I mean, it's totally different because, you know, writing a novel, you sit at your computer and you try to make the physical world present through your words. And in the thing I'm doing now, it's completely different. I'm taking objects and trying to create a narrative from them.
But you know, this to me, kept me going. That's what kept the story going, was the pictures.
Well, it does slow you down because you want to study each page. You don't just read it and turn the page.
I know, but I couldn't put it down.
Right.
That was it. You know,
I mean, that's the whole thing. Is the act of reading it is different because it's, you know, it's looking at things and studying things and then reading the captions and the letters and other things that go along with it.
And then what's coming next? What are they going to do next?
So what's it like for your three sons to have two writers as parents? Do they love writing? Do they, you know...
Well, I mean, I think like a lot of kids, you know, they're not interested in becoming writers, which I think is probably a good call. I think it's hard being a writer. They're definitely proud of us, and they're interested in what we do, and sometimes there has been collaboration with us too. Our middle son is an aspiring filmmaker, and he. In fact, there are two videos on my website about the book, and he made those.
Oh, that's great. How old was he when he did that?
Oh, you know, he just did that last year.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. Sometimes you have these, you know, like the kids all seem to know so much more about technology than any of the grown-ups.
That's
now,
for
so.
Sure. They do. But anyway, now he did that last year. But then he also, you know, he was in art school when I first started this project, and
uh-huh.
he was one of the first people that I... showed my pages too, and he sort of helped me sort of do some of the construction of things. So, you know, they're interested. They're interested in what we do, and you know, interested in you know coming to readings and supporting what we do. But their lives have gone in different directions, and I think that's probably for the best.
Do they live nearby?
One of my sons lives in Baltimore and works for a bank, and. I have another son who lives in Brooklyn, and I have a third son who's still in college.
Mm.
Well, I can see where your son who went to art school would really appreciate this book and be able to give you some, you know, a little bit of feedback on the layout because it's so visual.
Of course, it was really interesting because here I'm writing this book about a woman in the 1920s, and to have them be interested or their friends be interested in that period, I mean, it's sort of fun for me.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily think they would be.
Do you have any young people besides your own children who are coming to you and kind of wanting to be mentored? Or do people contact you online and ask you for pointers on how to write or how to create?
Ask me. I mean, people, no, I wouldn't say mentored. I mean, I think people are interested in what I do. And I have spoken to... I've spoken to high schools. I've spoken to an MFA program in at George Mason, and you know, I actually went to that class and had them do some exercises about how to construct a graphic novel. And so, I think it was really more that it was opening their eyes to different possibilities of writing and ways of storytelling.
Uh-huh.
But I have not. I mean, since my work is fairly specific about doing sort of this kind of archival scrapbook or with real ephemera. I think they perceive it as somewhat different than what they're doing, so I don't think that has happened yet. Maybe it will, but it hasn't yet.
I want to remind listeners, you're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. With me is Caroline Kilborn. We're the hosts, and our guest today is Carolyn Preston, who has written her fourth book, The Scrapbook of Frankie Pratt, A Novel in Pictures. And we've just been discussing the generation coming after you and, you know, what they might be looking for. Do you ever think of writing nonfiction? Because all your books so far have been historical fiction, it sounds like. Is that right?
Pretty much, I would say that. At this point, no. I don't think so. I mean, that would be a different thing to write nonfiction. You know, I could write about, you know, a real character or something like that and create their scrapbook from real papers. But I like the imaginative freedom you have.
So you don't see yourself doing a how-to on scrapbooking?
Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. I mean, maybe I might do something or a history, more in the history of scrapbooks.
That would be interesting.
There has been a really good book that's been recently published on the history of scrapbooks. At this point, a book is an incredibly time-consuming thing, especially when you're doing something that has graphics in it. So at the moment, I'm more attracted by fiction. I mean, if I have more, there are more hours in the day and I have more time, I might try something like that.
Do you foresee a time, perhaps, when you might have grandchildren that you might consider writing children's books? Seems like children's picture books.
I would like to sort of try writing something that might be more of a, like a YA book or something. you know, I sort of had a thought on that. And, you know, I'd love to have grandchildren, but at this point, the idea that I have grandchildren who could read, I mean,
it's going to be a while.
It seems like it's pretty distant. But I think it'd be interesting to do something like that.
What's a typical work day like for you?
Well, I have a really wonderful, I mean, it's a complete mess. As I'm sitting here, I'm looking at it, but I do have a very beautiful studio in my house. It's a two, you know, high ceiling and big windows, and that we sort of built onto the house. And, you know, I have an enviable life. I get to kind of go in to my office and sort of work with all these really wonderful archival objects and letters and read old magazines and stacks and stacks of old magazines. And so anyway, I get up, you know, I probably get into my office around 9 o'clock, and I basically work on and off all the way through to about 6.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there are lots of, I mean, I'm not, again, I'm doing a million other things, too.
Well, know, it sounds like it's almost fun for you, too.
And, but anyway, pretty much, I kind of stay out in my office, sort of pretty focused on trying to do a certain number of pages and or things per day, and to produce a novel in a timely fashion. It's really what it takes. It's kind of, you know, work every day.
Once you have given your proposal to a publisher, do they say, okay, we want this in such and such a time, or do they put a time restraint on you at all?
Yes. I sold my first book on the basis of a chapter, and then they gave me a deadline for when they wanted the book.
That's pretty impressive for a person who hadn't had a book out yet. I thought often they like to see the whole manuscript first when you haven't yet published a book. So that must have been a really good first chapter.
With this book, I had published a book, but nothing like this. No, that's right. It is. It was a real leap of faith, and I think they were really pleased with it. Mean, I think, you know, as I said several times, they were really pleased with the way it turned out. I mean, I think they felt like it turned out better than they ever sort of dreamed it might. And what was the second part of the question?
I have no idea, but do you have any, we don't have too much time left.
Oh, no, it was something about you. I published it, oh.
Oh, I was just mentioning that it's unusual to sell a first book.
The time schedule
right.
About,
yeah, constraint of.
Yeah, you know, they gave me something like a year, and then they've also bought a second book, and so, so anyway, but we're in the process of changing the schedule around a little bit because I think I'm going to change what I'm doing a little bit. But, you know, they're
of course they know they know what yeah they
also,
know they know.
I have to say pretty good about making my deadlines. So you know, I mean, if I went and said, I mean, I got my first book done in a little over a year.
Because they know what you're capable of, so
yeah.
They, you know.
And I mean, you know, again, I mean, they're pretty easygoing. But if I completely missed my deadline, I don't think they would have been so. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Do you have any advice for other people who have not maybe yet succeeded in selling their work, but they're interested in writing?
I think there's some really basic things, certainly some basic things that I've learned myself, which is, pursue your own interests. And write the kind of books that you like to read. You know, don't suddenly go write mysteries because you think everyone is reading mysteries. So it has to be from the heart, and you have to sort of pursue the interests, your own interests. And I think it is really, really important to keep. You know, we live in an exciting time with a lot of alternative kinds of narrative coming out of, you know, people publishing electronically or combining different forms of media, and I think it's really important for people to keep an open mind and be experimental about what they or some of the forms they do, because I think that's where things are heading.
Well, you were very experimental in creating the scrapbook of Frankie Pratt. Why don't you mention once more your website if people are interested in seeing exactly what kind of book this is?
It is carolinepreston.com. That's CAROLINEP kerreston.com. And yeah, that has information on how to buy the book, and you can get in touch with me, and you can see pages from the book.
And the pages from the book are very, very interesting.
Oh,
very
they
layered.
Are. Yeah, they are. It's great. It really is. Really is.
How has it been working with an editor?
I've always had good luck with editors. My first editor was named Jane Rosenman, and I worked with her for 3 books. And then my new editor on this book is Lee Boudreau at Echo, and she's just incredibly enthusiastic and sensitive about this project. And the way we edited it is I had laid out the pages, and then I gave her some colored Xeroxes of the pages from the book, which she wrote on and commented on. And interestingly enough, the book was edited by 3 different people at the same time.
Oh.
The editor, the copy editor, and the graphic designer all made notations and copies on it. Comments on it. Because when I revised the book, I had to sort of rip up all the captions and redo them and glue them down again. I mean, it's done this very, I'm hoping that I can do more of this stuff online next time. But
sort of like the way we used to do the school newspaper when I was a kid, where you actually had to...
It was, where you do a little typing and then wax it on and everything. So they kind of did it so that they... they had me make all the changes at once, so I didn't have to keep redoing it. And her comments were good. I mean, there were some things that I expanded, and some things we sort of changed it around. But basically, I wouldn't say that I did massive change. It was just mostly fine-tuning rather than really drastically changing the book.
Well, that's great, since it was an experimental book, more or less, kind of in a new and different form. I think we're coming about to the end of our time. We've really enjoyed hearing about this very unique book, The Scrapbook of Frankie Pratt.
Well, thank you for all your great questions. It was really fun talking to you. I always loved a chance to talk about this book, because it was such a joy to do.
Well, thank you for being here, and I think...
I have a joke I have to tell.
Okay, we're going
to
hear a joke, and
about writers.
We'll bid you adieu.
This is about writers. This gentleman, who is a children's book writer, was contacted by his publisher, and he said, come in first thing tomorrow. And so he did, and he said, now I need a children's book by tomorrow morning. We're going to press. And the author looked at him. He said, now wait a minute. He said, it's not like fixing a hamburger, and I'm not McDonald's. And the publisher said, okay, that's all right. Then I'll pay somebody else $10,000 to do it. Okay, do you want fries with that? I love that joke.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being with us. This is KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, Writers' Voices.
Thank you very much.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at kruufm.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.